Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's take a look and see what's on the docket. First, what was the key factor for Jussie Smollett's conviction? A juror will tell us why. The defense is gearing up for the defense case in chief in the Ghislaine Maxwell matter. We've got an update on the Delphi murder. What does a sexual deviant look like? Can you tell? A California woman was arrested for shoplifting $328,000 in goods. An example of what a disgruntled employee can do to your company. We've also got an update on a case that we brought to you months ago. Will there be criminal charges? We'll have to wait and see. And then on our dumb criminal, hell has no fury like a woman scorned, even a 75-year-old woman. Let's talk about it. It is Monday, December 13th, 2021. We've got a big docket for you, so let's get started. First, if you haven't done so, though, please hit that subscribe button. Hit that little bell so you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. All right, first on the docket, what was the key factor for Jussie Smollett's conviction? Let's talk about what a juror had to say regarding the trial. So a female juror in the Jussie Smollett trial has come forward and explained the reasons why the jury felt there was no way they could acquit Mr. Smollett in his trial for staging the fake hate crime attack. Now, the juror said that the jury did not have any major disagreements when deliberations began, but they did take up to 9 hours to deliberate properly and consider all of the evidence presented. Now, this juror said that some of the jurors doubted that the prosecutors had proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt when the deliberations began. But those people really just wanted more time to look over the evidence. So Mr. Smollett, who is an openly gay black actor, for nearly 3 years denied accusations that he hired two brothers as assailants in this alleged attack. He testified in his own defense during this one-week trial. And the juror said that they felt Smollett's answers didn't have credible reasoning, especially when there was zero evidence to back up his story. Now, the juror said that the jury was eager to hear from Frank Gaston, Mr. Smollett's creative director, who initially called police in 2019. Now, Gaston was on the list of witnesses to testify, but was never called. Ultimately, the jury said the jury found testimony from the Osundario brothers hired to attack Mr. Smollett to be more convincing. The brothers gave very damning testimony that Mr. Smollett had paid them to carry out the task of roughing him up and slipping a noose around his neck after dousing him in bleach. The jurors also believed that Mr. Smollett had walked the brothers through a dry run the day before. The jurors stated that Mr. Smollett's defense attorney seemed to be just shooting from the hip with her approach to the trial. She threw out unsubstantiated claims that didn't sit well with the jurors. There was the claim that, for example, the brothers wanted a $2 million payout from Mr. Smollett to change their story. She said that, in contrast, the prosecutor, Dan Webb, had a methodical plotting style that made his argument seem watertight to the jurors. The juror said that we were told it was an aggravated battery because Smollett said they were wearing a mask. This is according to the juror. But in all, Smollett's accounts of what happened, he mentioned a mask. She added, "I just hope that Mr. Smollett and his attorneys know we went in there with an open mind. We listened to both sides. We wanted to make sure that those who had doubts didn't feel pressured." So let's talk about this. This is what I've said about doing trials for the last 26 years. First, you have to have a credible defense, okay? Jurors take their jobs very seriously. They do go into it with a very open mind, assuming that everybody has been honest in the jury selection process. And what was the key thing here? Mr. Smollett, according to the juror, didn't have anything to corroborate what he was saying. And if you look at any good case that's put together, the prosecution puts up a witness, and then they try to corroborate what that witness said, usually with some sort of documents or through other witnesses. So it's not just hanging your hat on what one person says. That's what jurors look for. They want to be certain that they're getting it right. Now, if it's just two people in a room and it's he said, she said, they'll make that decision. But what did this ultimately come down to? The juror said the Osundario brothers were more credible than Mr. Smollett in his version of the events. Now, the juror didn't say that Mr. Smollett lied, but let's face it, there was a pretty huge disparity between the two versions. So this wasn't just, oh, I perceived something differently in a crowded room. This was two distinct versions of events that either took place or didn't. The jury ultimately believed that the prosecution's case was proven beyond a reasonable doubt to five of the six counts. But it just shows you what I have said all along. Jurors take their jobs very, very seriously. They want to do a good job. They want to get it right. And whatever decision the jury makes, you usually have to respect it because that is the decision that they made based upon the evidence and the law that was presented to them. If there were legal errors, that's for a higher court to determine. But the reality of it is they always take their jobs very seriously. I've never seen a situation where jurors were dismissive of the facts or the law. This is the most important thing that most people will do in their life is jury service, and they want to get it right. All right, next on the docket, the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. Well, it's not resuming until Thursday of this week. Why is it taking so long, you say, Scott? Because the prosecution rested Friday afternoon. Why isn't the defense ready to go? Is the defense unprepared? No. Let me explain why. And if I was the judge in the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, I would be very upset. The prosecutors originally stated that this trial would go for 6 weeks and that the prosecution needed that time to present their case because they had endorsed a plethora of witnesses that they said were necessary to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. They rested their case after about 8 days of testimony. It was a rather short amount of time. Now, let me tell you what judges don't like. They don't like to waste their time, and they don't like to waste jurors' times, okay? Because nothing's taking place. The court's docket is extremely busy. And if your trial only takes 2 weeks, but you told the court that it had 6 weeks, they didn't schedule things during that time period. And guess what? That means somebody's sitting in custody or a civil case is getting continued and nothing's taking place. This judge has got to be livid. So is this the defense's fault? No. I put it clearly on the prosecution's fault because they overestimated their time. So why doesn't the defense have their witnesses ready to go? Well, they were under the impression, more than likely, that the government's case was going to take weeks and now they have to reschedule all of these particular individuals and make arrangements for their hotel, travel, food, everything that you would expect when somebody's taking care of your trip. And to reschedule all those witnesses, well, it can be somewhat complicated. So where do we stand then in the defense case in chief? Well, one of Ghislaine Maxwell's attorney, Bobby Sternheim, said in a letter filed Sunday with the court that the defense team is still trying to make these travel arrangements for the witnesses, some of whom are traveling from locations out of the district and abroad. And when they mean the District of New York, which is the jurisdiction of the court. And the defense now intends to call 35 witnesses, some of whom will testify under their first name or a pseudonym based upon the court's previous ruling. Now, based upon Sternheim's letter, there will likely be additional legal wrangling over whether the identity of the witnesses can be revealed and the potential impact that that may have on the case. A request from the government also filed Sunday with the court said that the defense provided its witness list on Friday after the government rested its case, but did not disclose when Ms. Maxwell's lawyers plan on having each witness testify. Now, what does that mean? It depends on who shows up, right? You have 35 witnesses. Yes, you would have a preferred order you'd like to call your witnesses in that particular order. But given the fact that the government has basically moved everything up by about a month, the defense is probably going to take whomever they can get on the witness stand first. And the defense, as a courtesy, and if the court orders it, will have to tell the order, but they don't have to say exactly when that's going to be. It's subject to availability. So the possibility of the defense's 35 witnesses plus a potential fight over allowing the degree of anonymity likely means that the trial won't be finished by Christmas. Now, the defense has endorsed 35 witnesses. Do they really intend to call all 35 of those? My guess is probably not. But when the defense endorses those 35 witnesses, guess what? The government then has to go prepare for 35 witnesses. even though there may only be a handful of witnesses called. It's called strategy. The government had asked for an order directing Ms. Maxwell's legal team to provide its intended witnesses for Thursday and Friday of this week by 10 a.m. on Monday, today. And the government also asked that Ms. Maxwell's full witness order be filed by Tuesday. Now, the prosecution said that it's provided its witness information well ahead of trial. Well, guess what? The government has to do that. The defense, remember, doesn't have to present any evidence. And so the fact that the prosecution doesn't know exactly which witness will be called and when, so what? It's called, maybe the defense will do professional courtesy saying, hey, I'm going to call this witness, this witness, and then this witness, but they don't have to. So trial will resume on Thursday. And I think this is when it's going to be very interesting in the Ghislaine Maxwell matters to who is called. And the next thing is, it's always a big risk for the defense to call any witnesses. The prosecutor's case didn't go as well as I think the prosecution had hoped it was. And so the question is always, do you just rest and say the government hasn't proven their case? And since the defense never has to prove their client innocent, it's always riskier when you put on evidence. I can tell you from my perspective, and I have won more cases when the defendant doesn't testify or present any evidence, in my humble opinion, just because it goes from looking at the evidence that the government has presented to now adding more information. Sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. A lot of times it hurts, particularly if they do not believe the defendant, if the defendant chooses to testify. Next on the docket, an update on the Delphi murders. We brought you some information last week about this site, and it turned out the photo was basically taken from a model's website, and the guy's now a police officer in Alaska. But her grandfather, one of the victim's grandfathers, Libby German, her grandfather has spoken out. So for a lot of people, and some people don't know, back in February of 2017, Libby German, and her friend Abigail Williams, both 14, were murdered in Delphi, Indiana, after taking a walk together. Now, investigators thus far have not arrested anyone in connection with the murder, but authorities this week announced that a person using a social media account named Anthony_Shots was attempting to talk with and meet underage girls around the same time of the killings. Now, the creator of the fictitious profile attempted to give the appearance of wealth, posting images of cash and luxury vehicles to lure in young girls and solicit nude images and to obtain their addresses. What police did not voluntarily disclose that a man who had the same Snapchat and Instagram persona of Anthony and then _Shots is a suspected pedophile who's already in custody. So there's some court records that tie the account to a 27-year-old by the name of Keegan Anthony Klein, who was detained on child charges 10 days after the girls were killed in 2017. Police arrested Klein less than 40 miles from the girls' bodies where they were found. Now, Indiana State Police have not confirmed whether the girls were in contact with Anthony_Shots on their account or why it has apparently become a recent focus of the investigation. Authorities have not charged Klein in connection with the Delphi case, and his attorney has denied that he was involved in any way whatsoever. Now, authorities have also never released publicly how the girls were in fact killed. Now, Mike Patty, who's German's grandfather, said he hopes this week's developments leads to finding the killer. He said, I quote, "I think it's another piece of the puzzle, period." All right, we'll see. The plot seems to be thickening on the Delphi murders. I hope they make an arrest on that rather soon. We'll just have to wait and see. But you can take a look there at Mr. Klein. Does he look like a guy who's going to use somebody else's photograph, sit in his mother's basement and try to lure in young girls? Certainly we're going to give him the presumption of innocence, but you make up your own mind. All right, what does a sexual deviant look like? Well, could it be that he looks like Mr. Klein? Or could he look like this guy, Mr. John Griffin, who we will give the presumption of innocence to, right? Well, he's been criminally charged with enticing minors to engage in unlawful activity of the sexual nature. Now, the charges against the 44-year-old Stamford, Connecticut resident were announced Friday by the Vermont Department of Justice. Now, according to the DOJ, Griffin allegedly used a messaging app like Kik and Google Hangouts to speak with the parents of minor daughters. Authorities allege his overall goal was to try to convince the mothers to allow him to train their daughters to be sexually submissive. It's alleged that Griffin conveyed thoughts, including one that a woman is a woman regardless of her age, and that women should be sexually subservient and inferior to men. The indictment also cited that Griffin allegedly advised the mother of a 9-year-old and a 13-year-old girl to make sure their older daughter was trained properly. Now, the mother was given $3,000 for a plane ticket so she and the 9-year-old girl could leave Nevada and travel to Boston's Logan Airport. Eventually, in July of 2020, the mother and daughter allegedly flew out to Boston, where Griffin picked both up in his car, a Tesla. The two were given a ride to his Ludlow, Massachusetts house, where he engaged the daughter in unlawful sexual activity. This is all according to the indictment. Now, Mr. Griffin also stands accused of attempting to entice two other children online to engage in sexual activity. One of the incidents allegedly took place in April of 2020 when he tried to push a mother and daughter to engage in a virtual training session via video, which involved him trying to guide the mother and her 14-year-old daughter to strip and touch one another. In the second incident, Griffin allegedly suggested to a woman appearing to be the mother of a 16-year-old girl that the two take a little mother-daughter trip to his Ludlow home for the sole purpose of sexual training. Now, each count carries a minimum of 10 years in prison. And the indictment also alleges a count of forfeiture where the government plans to confiscate Mr. Ludlow's home, his Mercedes-Benz, and his Tesla, which were allegedly used in the crime. Now, what makes this possibly a little more interesting than just the average everyday perv out there is that, well, this guy worked at CNN. And CNN issued a statement saying the charges against Mr. Griffin are deeply disturbing. We learned of his arrest yesterday afternoon and have suspended him pending investigation. Now, according to his LinkedIn profile, Mr. Griffiths claimed to have worked shoulder to shoulder with CNN's Chris Cuomo since April of 2013. And as a lot of people know, Mr. Cuomo was recently fired from CNN over having allegedly provided public relations assistance in connection with his brother and former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's sexual assault harassment scandal. And obviously, Mr. Cuomo at CNN also had some allegations of some sexual harassment issues as well and has been fired. Obviously, everyone's given the presumption of innocence until they're convicted or a plea of guilty has entered. But what a great transition, ladies and gentlemen. Now, isn't that a great transition as to why everyone should go to crimetalksearch.com, right? Because you don't necessarily know with whom you are dealing with out there in today's world. You need to check them out, okay? Go to crimetalksearch.com and you'll get a background search while you wait, literally while you wait, and it'll provide information regarding one's criminal history, whether they're a registered sex offender, whether they have bankruptcies, whether they've been divorced, whether they're still married. Those important things you wanna know in life. And we've had more people send us testimonials saying, I was gonna start dating this guy and then I found out he had convictions and charges for doing terrible things to children. Thank God I found this. So go check it out. It is a subscription service that you can cancel at any time, whether you're gonna be dating somebody, maybe you just don't get the warm fuzzy feeling with somebody at an office or your neighbors, check them out. It's the smart thing to do. Go to crimetalksearch.com. And you may also wanna check out, see if they have a criminal history for stealing $300,000 worth of goods. Like this woman in Southern California. She's been charged on Friday with multiple felonies after allegedly stealing more than $328,000 of merchandise from designers, including Jimmy Choo, Gucci, Prada. Ekaterina Zarkova, 38, of Costa Mesa, has been charged with 4 felony counts of grand theft, 1 felony count of receiving stolen property, and 7 misdemeanor counts of petty theft, all according to the Orange County District Attorney's Office. Zarkova reportedly filled a shopping cart with designer items before covering the items with a coat and using a device to take off the security sensors. This is according to the investigators, and they were following her closely. She then allegedly left the store without going to the checkout. Now, investigators then followed Zarkova to her car, parked at the South Coast Shopping Plaza before taking her into custody. 2 days later, she posted a $20,000 bond and was released. Investigators shared pictures of Zarkova's vehicle with its front passenger side, back seat, and trunk all filled with the alleged stolen items. Zarkova's arrest came before Los Angeles Police Chief Michael Moore said last Thursday that more than 150 follow-home robberies have been reported so far in 2021. Now, many victims were targeted because they wore expensive jewelry and drove luxury vehicles. Chief Moore added that 36 arrests have been made so far involving these follow-home robberies, and some of those arrests came after detectives trolled suspects on social media who posted photos of themselves with the stolen goods and actually bragging about it. So robberies in the Los Angeles area have increased by 3.9% in 2020, but in the area of the Melrose Avenue shopping area located in West Hollywood, shoplifting has increased by 20%. Now, this lady, she is a professional criminal. This is how she makes her living. And all it does is cost society more because the stores don't stop anybody. And the conduct of people like Ms. Zarkova just costs society more. The stores don't shop anybody. They lose the products. They increase their prices because of the lost items that they don't recover on. It's just something where the law-abiding citizens simply pay more and more for this wrongful misconduct. All right, next let's talk about what a disgruntled employee can do. Nicholas Burks, he runs a sweepstakes site called Raffle of the Day, where he gives away lavish prizes such as Rolex watches, PlayStation 5 S's, and even Corvettes and Dodge Chargers. But how did he get all that seed money to start his sweepstakes sites? Well, it's alleged that it all started when the Tennessee-based tech support firm Asurion fired Mr. Burks for performance-related reasons. Upon his exit, it's alleged that he stole a company laptops, and Mr. Burks then allegedly later used the laptop to download sensitive internal corporate information. He got in touch with the company executives listing the data that he stole, including employees' social security numbers, banking information, as well as customer names and addresses, and proceeded to demand a ransom. He threatened that if he didn't receive hundreds of thousands of dollars within 24 hours, he would publish the stolen data, according to court records. The company paid $300,000 in cryptocurrency. Burks allegedly used services to keep the cryptocurrency exchange anonymous and redistributed the money to other accounts, including the Raffle of the Day site. Now, the feds have since seized Mr. Burks' raffle website, alerting those who want to participate in his raffle of those that have in the past that they have likely been victims of fraud. In recent months, the Raffle of the Day Instagram page advertised its services by claiming Nick can teach people how to make seven figures and how to start and scale your very own business. Asurion worked with the federal authorities to catch Mr. Burks, and he has since been arrested. Now, while the company declined to provide any additional details regarding their cooperation to law enforcement, a 2019 federal search warrant application laid out some of the efforts to snuff out Mr. Burks' scheme. Asurion began paying $50,000 to the extortionist while launching an internal investigation and contacting the FBI. An investigation which included watching Burks and Asurion paid him a $5,000 installment. Now, Mr. Burks was arrested in Georgia and released on bond pending his trial. The criminal prosecution is ongoing, though, and his raffle site has been seized by the feds, but the sweepstakes' apparent Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram accounts are still accessible. Be aware, ladies and gentlemen. Be aware. Sounds like the feds will have it all really soon. All right, let's give you an update on a case that we talked about a few months ago. So Mario Gonzalez died in police custody on April 19th of this year, and his death was ruled a homicide, according to the coroner's report that was released last Friday. Now, Mr. Gonzalez died after police pinned him to the ground face down for more than 5 minutes. The altercation was recorded on police body cam video and captured a dazed Mr. Gonzalez struggling to answer questions before the officers tried to restrain him. Now, the death of Mario Gonzalez was caused by the toxic effects of methamphetamine, according to the autopsy report from the Alameda County Coroner's Office. The stress of the altercation with the three police officers combined with alcoholism, and morbid obesity contributed to his death, according to the report. Now, in an interview last week, lawyers representing the Gonzalez family said that the report shows that the methamphetamine in his system was recreational amounts and clearly not enough to kill him. Well, according to the coroner, it was a contributing factor to that. But the lawyers for Mr. Gonzalez say that what killed him was the Alameda Police Department and their officers forcing him down in the dirt, putting the body weight on him, and pinning him to the ground. The attorneys for the Gonzalez family have compared Mr. Gonzalez's death to the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis Police Department. Now, it isn't clear if the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, which is investigating the death, will bring charges against any of the officers. Now, an office spokesman said Friday that the probe is ongoing and declined to comment any further. Attorney Allison Barry Wilkinson, who is representing the officers, said it was the toxic level of drugs, not the actions of the officers, that killed Mr. Gonzalez. She further added that there was nothing in the report about any technique that were used that were unreasonable or excessive. The officers who were involved in the death for Mr. Gonzalez are on administrative leave, and their peace officer rights are suspended until this process is completed. Now, in the video, Mr. Gonzalez is lying face down, shouting and grunting while police are asking him questions like his full name and date of birth. "We're going to take care of you, okay?" One officer can be heard saying, adding, "I think you just had too much to drink." After roughly 5 minutes, Mr. Gonzalez appears to lose consciousness. He was later pronounced dead at the local hospital. Mr. Gonzalez's family filed a claim against the city of Alameda earlier this year, accusing officers of excessive force and notifying authorities that they intended to file a lawsuit. And the attorney for the family says that they intend to do so very soon. This is a tough case. We, I believe, actually put up the videos, I think, for our Patreon members, so you can take a look at it and you can decide if the police did something wrong, or was this just a fait accompli with a circumstances of morbid obesity, methamphetamine, alcohol, and the police officers all contributing to the death? Or maybe the officers were just doing the best job they could. And when you are put in this type of situation, sometimes bad things happen. And finally, on today's docket, our dumb criminal of the day. Last week's winner, that's right, the unidentified woman who was walking around our building here, which houses the Crime Talk studio, who picks up rocks and randomly throws rocks at the building window, breaking them. Fortunately, nothing happened, but how dumb can you be? It's on video. Hopefully they find him, but probably nothing's going to happen to this person other than the building owner is going to replace the windows and more than likely pass the cost off to the tenants in the building. Just random acts of criminal mischief. It's got to stop, ladies and gentlemen. To break somebody's stuff just because you can break somebody's stuff, just don't get it. All right, let's get on to today's. We talked about it. Hell has no fury like a woman scorned. Even 75-year-old women. All right, 75-year-old Florida woman Patsy Morell was arrested for allegedly targeting her 74-year-old ex-boyfriend, Stephen Hughes, and his new girlfriend in an auto vandalism spree. Now, Hughes's 2011 Chrysler had oil poured into air vents and the words "loves kinky sex" and "womanizer" written on the window in pink lipstick. The auto allegedly also sustained damage to its rear bumper, allegedly when Ms. Morell rammed the car with her vehicle. The estimated damage and the repairs are about $1,600. Now, the new girlfriend's BMW was also destroyed by Ms. Morell's alleged oil pouring adventures, and also put a dead raccoon that was left on the hood of the car, also with the word "slut" written on the vehicle in pink lipstick. Now, Ms. Morell was arrested Wednesday morning on a pair of felony criminal mischief counts. Ladies and gentlemen, you just can't make this stuff up. All right. I want to thank you all for watching. We appreciate every time that you do. And remember, if you can't watch us on YouTube, you can download us. Go to any one of your podcast providers. Simply type in Crime Talk with Scott Reich, and you can listen to us anytime, along with all of the past episodes, if you haven't watched those as well. All right. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.